Beginning around 1980 and spanning over 21 years, forensic scientist Joyce Gilchrist worked for the Oklahoma City Police Department. During that time, she earned the nickname Black Magic for her uncanny ability to make connections between evidence and perpetrators. She was also very convincing on the witness stand. Her contributions to cases and trials sent literally thousands of people to prison, with 23 of those individuals ultimately sentenced to death. Tragically, 11 of those people were already executed by the time an FBI review of Gilchrist's work demonstrated not only serious incompetence, but exposed her out-and-out lies, both in the lab and the courtroom. Gilchrist worked in several capacities within the Oklahoma City Forensic Lab, including trace evidence and forensic chemistry. She performed hair analysis, fiber examinations, and chemical and serological testing of body fluids, among other forensic procedures. Until her fraud was exposed, Gilchrist was considered an exemplary scientist. She was even named Employee of the Year in 1985 and was promoted to supervisor by 1994. But throughout her career, other forensic scientists were questioning her reliability as early as 1987. A colleague reported her wrongdoings to a regional forensic association. But at that time, nothing was done to stop or even seriously investigate Gilchrist. But sometime just before the spring of 2001, a secret FBI review was being conducted on her work. They looked at just 8 Gilchrist cases to start with and found that in at least 5 of them, she had made either serious mistakes or, in their words, went beyond, quote, acceptable limits of forensic science. One of the problems with evidence like hair, fiber, and even blood type is that they can only assign evidence to a relatively large category, not a particular individual. For example, although there are different hair forms and colors, a tremendous number of people would share the same patterns. That's also true of blood types. There are only 4 major blood groups, A, B, AB, and O, and billions of people share each of those types. The same goes for fiber evidence. Manufacturers mass produce clothing and carpeting, so the fibers from those sources are what we call in forensic science class evidence, not individuating evidence. Still, that didn't stop Joyce Gilchrist from using hairs, fiber, and blood to place suspects at crime scenes with a confidence that was scientifically completely unwarranted. Other accusations of her malpractice included not doing the tests that might demonstrate a suspect's innocence and withholding evidence from defense counsel that would help counter the prosecution's case. In that sense, Gilchrist is what I would call a hired gun. She was willing to say or do whatever it took to get a conviction for the police department she worked for. Gilchrist let her bias and ego get in the way of the objectivity that is the foundation of good science. Let me give you just a couple of disturbing examples of Gilchrist's long reign of terror. A 20-year-old named Mark Fowler was arrested in 1985 for an Oklahoma City grocery store robbery in which 3 people were killed. He was put to death by lethal injection in January of 2001, partly based on the testimony of Joyce Gilchrist. Now, Fowler was no angel. He admitted to robbing the store, along with a man named Billy Ray Fox. But Fowler blamed Fox, a disgruntled former employee of the grocery store, for herding the victims into the back room and killing them. Now, a year after Mark Fowler's trial, his own grandmother, Ann, was raped and murdered in Oklahoma City. A few months later, another elderly woman was raped and killed in the same neighborhood. While Fowler sat on death row, a man named Robert Lee Miller, Jr. was convicted of the murders of both Ann Fowler and her neighbor, again, largely owing to the testimony of Joyce Gilchrist. Miller was also given a death sentence. But 10 years later, in 1998, DNA evidence proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that Miller was not guilty, and showed that another man, one who Gilchrist earlier said could not have been the rapist and murderer, well, he was actually the perpetrator. Mark Fowler's father was not only faced with the murder of his mother and the execution of his son, but but also had to live with the knowledge that Joyce Gilchrist could have been wrong in his son's case, too. Let's look now at the two cases Miller didn't commit but was found guilty of. Keep in mind, this predated the common use of DNA technology in forensics and was before it was accepted in Oklahoma courts. Although serological testing was already providing glimpses of a person's genetics. Evidence collected in the two crime scenes included semen, blood, saliva, and hair. The perpetrator was determined to be blood type A when testing both blood and semen from both crime scenes. Some individuals are called secretors because they also express their blood type markers in other body fluids, like semen and saliva. Plus, the blood contained a particular genetic marker that at the time was said to be more common in African Americans than people from other ancestries. Now, given this information, police literally walked the neighborhood and requested blood samples from black males. That's how they came up with Robert Miller as their prime suspect. He not only lived where both victims had been attacked, but was also shown to be blood type A and a secretor. So police brought Miller in for questioning, and then he endured a 12-hour interview despite the suspicion he was high on drugs at the time. Using this interrogation, police led Miller to a false confession. Much of that interview was recorded and was later used to demonstrate that Miller was delusional during the questioning. Lots of the detail Miller presented was not at all consistent with the crimes committed. Despite the inaccuracies, Miller's trial hinged largely on that coerced confession, combined with the extensive testimony about blood, saliva, and hair that was delivered by Joyce Gilchrist. Gilchrist correctly testified that she could not exclude Miller as being the murderer, since he did have type A blood. But even though the crime scene body fluid testing revealed four genetic markers that were not present in Miller's blood, Gilchrist claimed that discrepancy did not exclude him. She said the crime scene samples could have been tainted by the victim's own blood, even though the victim wasn't type A. The hair analysis conducted by Gilchrist included both human and non-human hairs. She stated that human hairs recovered from the crime scene were Negroid hairs, and Robert Miller is African American. But just as with the inheritance of blood type, African ancestry is shared by a significant chunk of the population. And in case you're thinking Joyce Gilchrist may be a racist, she's also African American. With regard to the non-human hair that investigators found at one of the crime scenes, Gilchrist said it greatly resembled hair taken from a roving neighborhood dog that Miller was fond of. But how many other people in that general vicinity cared for and may have petted that dog, maybe even including the victim? As I mentioned earlier, analyses by Gilchrist were said to exclude another suspect, who the police had also been originally looking at hard in this case. That was an African-American guy named Ronald Lott. Turns out he's the man the 1998 DNA testing ultimately proved raped and murdered those two women, for which he was convicted in 2002. Lott turned out to be a serial rapist with additional victims and was executed in December of 2013. Robert Lee Miller Jr. now finally walks free after sitting in prison from 1988 to 1998, a decade of his life lost, and irreparable damage done to him and his family. Reanalysis of the hairs showed that Gilchrist's work was, in the words of the second analyst, quote, meaningless and completely unjustified. Due to the FBI investigation, which initially reopened several cases, the governor demanded that thousands of cases in which she was involved be reevaluated, and of course she was fired. Believe it or not, Gilchrist had the nerve to file a lawsuit against her former employer for over $20 million, claiming that she was really fired as retribution for a sexual misconduct charge that she made against a supervisor. Ultimately, it's been Gilchrist that has had to hand over money to former inmates who are now suing her for her part in their wrongful convictions. Sadly, though, some of them, maybe even Mark Fowler and the 10 others who were executed partly based on the work and testimony of Joyce Gilchrist, Well, they never lived to see justice served on her. Now, while some types of evidence, like hair and blood type, cannot be conclusively linked to one specific person, fingerprints, like DNA, can be, right? Well, during the morning rush hour on March 11, 2004, 10 bombs almost simultaneously detonated on 4 different trains in or heading to Atocha Station in Madrid, Spain. 191 people were killed and nearly 2,000 injured, making this one of the worst acts of terror in Europe since World War II. Investigators fairly quickly discovered that the bombs had been placed in backpacks and detonated by mobile phones. Because the incident occurred 3 days before Spain's general election, the attack was originally thought to be the work of a Basque separatist organization known as the ETA. But suspicions quickly turned toward the Al-Qaeda terrorist group, since at that point, Spain's president, José María Aznar, was allied with the U.S. president, George W. Bush, and Spain was involved in the Iraq War. As a side note, Aznar was defeated in that general election by José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, who removed Spanish troops from Iraq by May of 2004, just 2 months after the bombing incident. Another potential link to Al-Qaeda was that the bombing was 2 years and 6 months to the day after the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center in New York City, and would have been precisely 911, in other words, 911 days after it, if not for the leap year that had just occurred in February of 2004, technically making the bombing 912 days after 9/11. The attack didn't end with the train bombings, though. A few weeks later, 12 kilograms, that's almost 26.5 pounds, of a nitro-based high explosive was found on another train track in Spain. Although there were over 100 meters of wire connected to it, the other end of that wire was not connected to anything else. So as a bomb, the device was incomplete and non-functional. The day after discovering this inactive device, the Spanish National Police figured out who they thought was responsible and closed in on an apartment in West Madrid. At that point, the suspects in the building detonated another suicide bomb, killing 7 of their members and 1 policeman, and wounding another 11 officers. Some of the suspects got away. Spanish authorities determined the explosives used at the apartment were of the same type as the earlier devices used in both the actual and potential train bombings. While authorities had intelligence information about the group responsible, they initially didn't have much physical evidence to definitively link the crimes to any specific individuals. But while investigating around the scene of the train bombings, Spanish police recovered a blue plastic bag. Now, it contained 7 copper detonating devices, and as luck would have it, a single usable fingerprint was on the bag's surface. Over 5,000 miles away, just outside of Portland, Oregon, a 37-year-old attorney named Brandon Mayfield and his wife, Mona, started noticing some really strange happenings around the home they shared with their 4 children. They'd go out, and when they came back, would notice things weren't as they had left them. For instance, they knew they had closed a certain window blind only to find it slightly open. The couple's door had 2 locks on it, and they typically used only one and not the other. But when they came home, they'd find the door locked differently than the way it was when they left. And once, on her freshly vacuumed carpet, Mona saw a shoe print that she absolutely knew was not from a member of the family. It was their custom not to wear shoes in the house, as they were Muslims. They suspected a burglar had somehow gotten in, but nothing they owned was missing. Even more eerie was that this happened to the Mayfields on more than one occasion. Where is this mystery going, you might ask? Well, Brandon Mayfield was born in Oregon in 1966. At age 20, he met his future wife, Mona, on a blind date. She was an Egyptian national and a Muslim, and as their relationship proceeded, he converted to the Islamic faith. When he met Mona, Mayfield was already in the United States Army Reserve, which he was a member of from 1985 to 89. In 1992, he joined the U.S. Army and was an officer until 1994. In 1999, Mayfield earned his law degree, and in addition to practicing family law, he worked for an Oregon State Bar Association organization that was dedicated to helping clients who couldn't afford legal representation. In 2003, Mayfield represented a man named Jeffrey Battle in a child custody matter. Now, Battle was one of a group of American Muslims known as the Portland Seven. They had been convicted of conspiring against the United States with the Afghani Taliban Islamic fundamentalist movement. So despite Mayfield's 10 years of military service to his country, other associations and possibly his religion apparently made him suspicious to authorities. They ultimately connected Brandon Mayfield to the Madrid train bombings. How on earth did that happen? Well, remember the fingerprint on the plastic bag containing the detonators? The Spanish National Police, working through the Paris-based international agency known as Interpol, made a request to the United States FBI. They asked that the Federal Bureau of Investigation compare that fingerprint to other prints using IAFIS technology. IAFIS stands for the Integrated Automated Fingerprint Identification System. That's the FBI's software database of digitized fingerprint records that can be searched against each other. Because Mayfield had been in the United States Armed Services, his fingerprints were on file at the national level. On March 19th of 2004, 8 days after the Madrid train bombing, the FBI's latent print unit identified Brandon Mayfield as the source of the fingerprint they recovered from the plastic bag. They cataloged that fingerprint as LFP-17, which stands for latent fingerprint number 17. In actuality, the IAFIS search had generated a list of about 15 to 20 most likely fingerprint candidates. Mayfield was only one of those possibilities. Now, IAFIS is automated, but its results are not definitive proof. Any system-suggested matches are always followed up with a comparison by the eyes of a qualified fingerprint examiner. In the course of his side-by-side examinations, FBI agent Terry Green reported over 15 points of similarity between Mayfield's known print and the latent print in question, concluding that Brandon Mayfield was the source of the unknown fingerprint. Not only that, but a second examiner concurred with the match. The chief of the FBI latent print unit also reviewed the comparison. All three confirmed that LFP-17 came from Mayfield. So that's what prompted the FBI to start 24-hour surveillance on Mayfield and conduct the clandestine physical searches of both his residence and his law office. The Mayfield family wasn't imagining things at home. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, commonly known as FISA, had been used as the legal authority to investigate Brandon Mayfield as potentially being one of the perpetrators of the Madrid train bombings. Further justification came from the USA Patriot Act of 2001, which most people don't realize is an acronym that stands for Uniting and Strengthening America by Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism. Ooh, I'll bet somebody stayed up all night coming up with that one. Now, the focus on Mayfield not only included his home and office, but also the family farm on which he grew up in Kansas. The search resulted from what's called a sneak and peek warrant. It allowed FBI agents to photograph papers at the Mayfield house, download their computer hard drives, and install sound monitoring devices to eavesdrop on the family's conversations. The FBI also gathered Mayfield's bank and telephone records. Despite the Fourth Amendment, which requires probable cause to get a warrant, FISA allows these sneak and peek activities when such covert operations will let authorities collect information on who they consider foreign agents. That includes U.S. citizens, so long as the main purpose of the surveillance is to gather foreign intelligence. The Patriot Act of 2001 allowed even greater freedom for law enforcement to monitor U.S. citizens than FISA did. Now, I know a retired FBI intelligence agent, and he told me about some of these procedures during those covert sneak and peek operations. First, the agents monitor the suspect. Once the person's habits and whereabouts are reasonably nailed down, they then bring in a team of specialists who are trained to get into a residence or office. Then they look around, set up monitoring devices, and leave without a trace. The team consists of lock experts guys that install listening devices, people that can plant hidden cameras, computer forensics experts, and even what they call a closer, who brings plaster, wood putty, and a painting kit to disguise any structural damage done by installing surveillance equipment. It really is pretty much like what we see on TV or in the movies. They post a lookout, which is probably why the Mayfield's window blinds had been disturbed. Then the rest of the FBI team quickly goes about setting up their gear and then gets out. Now, Mayfield ultimately told the media that the Portland FBI agents seemed pretty inept to him, since the couple immediately recognized that they were being watched. Okay, back to the fingerprint. Within about 3 weeks of identifying the print as Mayfield's, the FBI was contacted by the Spanish National Police. The Spanish authorities had independently determined that the print was, quote, conclusively negative as a possible match to Mayfield. Nonetheless, the FBI prepared an affidavit that was presented to a U.S. district court, and an arrest warrant was issued for Brandon Mayfield as what they termed a material witness in the Madrid bombing case. The FBI even went so far as to send an agent to Madrid to suggest that the Spanish National Police re-examine the fingerprint in light of all the things the FBI knew about Mayfield. See, the fingerprint wasn't the only evidence the FBI was acting on to arrest Mayfield. It's been suggested they also considered Mayfield's regular attendance at his local mosque, as well as the fact that his wife had placed a phone call to an Islamic charity that was being watched by the government for possible terrorist activities. Mayfield also advertised his law practice in a newsletter run by a guy that the FBI was already looking at for suspected links to terrorism. Brandon Mayfield was arrested at his law office on May 6, 2004. Simultaneously, FBI agents came to Mona Mayfield's door and said her husband's fingerprints had been found on a bag in Madrid near the site of the bombings. She said she had two thoughts. Either this is some kind of terrible mistake, or the FBI is trying to frame my husband. They detained and questioned Mona and conducted a six-hour search of the couple's property. This time, they didn't just download the family computer hard drives. They took their computers and modem, as well as the key to Mayfield's safety deposit box at his local bank. Among other things, they also confiscated several copies of the Quran from the home and papers containing Spanish writing, which later turned out to be one of the children's homework from a Spanish class. In the affidavit they used as justification for the arrest and search, the FBI claimed 100% positive identification of Mayfield from the fingerprint. The affidavit also had Agent Green reporting the Spanish National Police Agency as being satisfied with the FBI's conclusion, which was not true. At his hearing, Mayfield stated, "That's not my fingerprint, Your Honor." He said he hadn't been out of the country in several years, over 10, and he produced his passport that had expired in 2003. An investigation of airline record systems showed no record of a Brandon Mayfield traveling overseas. The FBI countered he could have used false documents and a pseudonym, even though Mayfield's whereabouts could be accounted for by family, friends, and clients during the time frame it would have taken him to get to Spain and back around the time of the bombing. Now, Spain denied the FBI's story and said the Americans simply refused the Spanish National Police's conclusions. In fact, Commissioner Carlos Corrales said he was surprised by the FBI's focus on Mayfield and stated, quote, "It seemed as though they had something against him and wanted to involve us." After further investigation of the fingerprint, on May 19th, Spanish authorities arrested an Algerian named Daoud, who was not only a definitive match to the print, but was also linked in other ways to the bombings. Once Spain issued an international arrest warrant for Daoud, U.S. authorities dismissed Mayfield's case. He was released from his 2 weeks of jail time without being charged. So, what went wrong here, and how did this mistake happen within one of the most sophisticated forensic laboratories in the world? In March of 2006, a 273-page report was released by the Office of Inspector General Glenn Fine regarding the misidentification of Brandon Mayfield as being involved in the Madrid train bombing. While the report concluded the FBI investigators did not abuse their powers, it did specify that by providing flawed information to multiple law enforcement agencies, that the USA Patriot Act might have complicated an already bad situation. The IG's office acknowledged that there certainly were similarities between the latent print found near the crime scene and Brandon Mayfield's fingerprint. But the report stated the FBI may have been over-reliant on its own expertise, especially by ignoring the opposing conclusion of the Spanish authorities, and that perhaps the FBI had been overconfident in IAFIS. Ultimately, though, FBI investigators, not the database, positively linked Mayfield to the fingerprint. IAFIS technology merely suggested him among a group of possibilities. The IG also speculated whether Mayfield's religion played a part in the misidentification of the fingerprint. The report concluded that at the time of their examination, the FBI fingerprint experts were not aware that Mayfield was Muslim, or that he was married to a Middle Eastern woman and had represented a member of the Portland 7 terrorist cell in a legal matter. But the issue wasn't as clear with regard to the rest of the FBI's investigation, or its failure to revisit the fingerprint comparison once the Spanish National Police concluded the print didn't come from Mayfield, since by that time the FBI was aware of all of Mayfield's particulars. The IG report stated there were conflicting accounts among FBI personnel they interviewed and others as to whether religion played a part in the Mayfield investigation. Perhaps it was more his association with other suspected terrorists that was to blame for the FBI's focus on Mayfield. In the end, though, the IG's report concluded it was the belief that the fingerprint belonged to Mayfield, not his religion, that caused the nation's highest policing agency to go after him. The FBI defended itself by suggesting the misidentification was because they had been working from a relatively poor digital copy of the fingerprint, not the original. They also claimed the print wasn't really suitable for identification, that there were gaps within the fingerprint, caused either by creases in the surface of the bag or multiple touches to the bag, or maybe both. But to counter that claim, the Inspector General's report argued that the Spanish National Police and later the FBI itself concluded the print belonged to Daoud. So how could it not be of sufficient quality for an ID? It was also noted in the IG's report that the latent print examiners gave too much weight to what we call minutiae in the fingerprint comparison. That refers to the smaller aspects of the print, like sweat gland pores and how and where print ridges end or split. This is like losing the forest in the trees, since once investigators were vested in the minutiae, they didn't back up again for the big picture. Mayfield and Daoud's prints were strikingly similar in the smallest of details, but they were clearly different in other, more meaningful ways. A print match has to be 100% certain. Any discrepancy that can't be explained away by the examiner is grounds for an exclusion. It was later shown that the FBI realized that a full one-quarter, the upper left quadrant, of LFP-17, it didn't match Mayfield's pattern. But they ignored this in favor of assuming that someone else had touched the bag in that exact place, creating a different pattern in that quarter of the fingerprint. All told, the IG's report said the multiple alternative theories that the FBI had to construct and string together in order to conclude that LFP-17 belonged to Mayfield simply rose to such a level of unlikelihood that the potential match should have been dismissed. The Inspector General's report also argued that once the examiners thought the latent print belonged to Mayfield, they started to work backward, using Mayfield's clear print to look for its similarities to the poorer quality unknown print, even though the latent print lacked detail and clarity. That's just not a sound scientific way to go about that kind of high-stakes comparison. The IG's report recommended several changes to the FBI laboratory procedures with regard to fingerprint identification. As part of its own self-analysis, the FBI likewise found no misconduct on the part of its employees, and to its credit, had already implemented changes in its practice even before the Inspector General's report was declassified and released to the public. In 2004, Brandon Mayfield filed a lawsuit against the United States Department of Justice, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and several specific employees of the FBI. The suit claimed that Mayfield's civil rights were violated by these agencies and persons in their pursuit of him as a suspect in the Madrid train bombings, and that his arrest was directly related to the fact that he is a Muslim. Mayfield won his suit and was awarded $2 million, along with a rare official apology from the FBI in exchange for dropping his claims against the government and its agents. Without a doubt, the IAFIS fingerprint database and comparison system is extremely useful as a forensic tool. But even the most sophisticated technology in the world cannot completely save us from human error or bias. And while the U.S. Inspector General did not implicate either the technology or the personnel in the Brandon Mayfield case, as we saw with Joyce Gilchrist, there have been forensic scientists who were clearly guilty of not mere mistakes, but rather serious, inexcusable malpractice.